Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the next episode of SCI TV. Today, we have an incredible guest, Josh Perry. Josh, thank you so much for joining us today. Well, there's so many things about Josh, and probably I'll never be able to give an introduction as well as he could, but I'm going to give it a try. So Josh is a former X Games athlete. He is a high-performance coach, and he has the most incredible story as to why he has come to, you know, the work that he does today and his experience as a BMX athlete. So Josh, I would love the opportunity if you could share a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, and thanks for having me, Anna. I appreciate it. I know our first conversation, just getting to know each other, you and I went pretty deep into the weeds right away, which is always a nice experience when we resonate with a an energy like that, and we explore these topics that I don't think are very commonly spoken about. So I appreciate that.
Thank you.
Yeah, well, I guess. I don't know where you want me to start.
At the beginning.
Okay.
Just let's talk about your background as an athlete, and then we'll tie it back to what you're doing today and some of the broader topics that, you know, our audience is always eager to hear about.
Yeah, for sure. I started playing sports at a young age. I was playing t-ball as early as I can remember. I was, you know, hitting balls, kicking balls, throwing balls. You know, I wanted to play baseball. I wanted to be in the NBA. I played roller hockey with my dad. All the things. And then along the way, it just became something I gravitated towards more and more. And I now realize, looking back, it just was somewhere where I could express myself freely and also be able to, you know, get out stored pent up energy. And along the way, it just became more of that space that felt comfortable being me, my fullest version, and just putting effort into expressing myself to the highest level I could. And then along the way, active sports came to my life in the late 90s, early 2000s. And I wanted to originally, as I got older, I wanted to go to the NBA. I wanted to play basketball. So I wanted to come out here to North Carolina to go to UNC, because that's where Michael Jordan went. And then didn't make the freshman basketball team my first year in high school. And I also was starting to place well at BMX contests. So the stars aligned, and I decided to pursue BMX, which I was progressing a lot quicker and more naturally, I'd say, than other sports. And then that's just where it started. And I just progressed really quickly, and I turned pro my junior year of high school.
Wow.
Dropped out because I actually got expelled from my senior year of missing the first 30 days of class in a row, because I was here at North Carolina training with all my heroes I looked up to and traveling the world and doing the thing I loved most. And that was back in 2007, so almost 20 years ago. And North Carolina is where I call home today. And along the way, I had many injuries, head injuries. The most significant injury I had was a torn ACL, and that was 3 years of torture riding on a torn ACL, and then meeting my wife today. But back then, she was the second athletic trainer I had ever worked with. Became good friends. She convinced me to get my knee fixed, and then had my best year competing, which ended up being my last year competing in 2016. And just a lot of the falling from high in the air to the ground, trying to do a trick just because you want to do a trick before it even became a career, taught me a lot about, you know, who I am and what I'm capable of. And people call it mindset, psychology, all the things. It was just learning how to pursue a vision that other people didn't understand, but I knew, or at least I thought, I could make it happen. And that really, that skill, and I say it's a skill intentionally because it can be developed, but that skill is what I believe saved my life. Along the last 11 years of my career, I had multiple brain tumor diagnoses that started with a head injury that led to an MRI one day. And that's when they discovered the first of multiple brain tumors. And that was a catalyst to start shifting my identity and getting on the path of helping people and the work I do today.
But from, I recall from our first conversation, you continued to compete, right? After the first surgery.
Yeah, so the first surgery was in 2010. I can give you the quick timeline, but I stopped competing in end of 2016. October was my last year competing, and I still rode and trained at the same level for an additional 4 years, basically because I didn't know who I was without doing the thing. But I wasn't earning a living competing anymore. And I didn't have sponsors. I'd already started my coaching program or my coaching business and working with people in that capacity, but I just didn't know who I was unless I did that thing and at that level, which had a lot of risk. And I finally recognized that risk later on. But yeah, 2010 was the first diagnosis and surgery. 2012 was a recurrence scan that led to a form of treatment called gamma knife radiation therapy. Basically zapped the two tumors that recurred. And then I was, you know, stable for 5 more years. And then a third diagnosis revealed 2 additional tumors on the other side of my brain. So at that time I was living with 4 and competing with 4 without even realizing it until the MRI. And then that was 2017. So the third diagnosis with 4 additional. And then we monitored them for years. And I got really in tune with metabolic health and doing my best to whatever I could do in my control to take care of my environment inside my body and externally and the things I consumed. And
yeah,
that went well. And then 2021, I had a seizure in my sleep and woke up and had a 5th brain tumor at the time, a golf ball sized tumor in my frontal lobe. And then that led to an awake brain surgery in September of 2021 in Mayo Clinic or in Jacksonville at Mayo Clinic with Dr. Quinones. And that was the first time in 11 years I was tumor free. And then 2 years later, to start January of 2023, I went through my second round of gamma knife radiation for 2 additional recurrences that were very small. And since then, I mean, not clean scans because they're still tumors, however you want to justify that, but stable growth or stable scans, no growth.
That is just, I don't know, like the resilience and the mental strength that, you know, you have. And I feel like the fact that you're not giving up and you're also developing as an individual through all of these challenges. And I feel like when you were an athlete before and versus what you had to go through now, I'm curious, has your definition of what it means to win changed over time, given the experiences that you've had?
100%, because I didn't know this before, but winning the contest or not winning it, it never equated to losing if I got second or third. It was actually something I was really proud of. So the higher levels of, or the highest level I could possibly go. But the idea of winning, I didn't know. I had so much of my identity and survival wrapped in it because it equated to how much money I made or didn't make if I won or didn't place first. And today I realized that the old identity I had couldn't have seen it any other way because that old identity was built from a negation of self. So what I mean by that is growing up, I didn't feel safe. I didn't feel good enough. And I identified, realizing that I identified with that. So as that thing of play and passion in my bike turned into a career, it just became a perfect connection to be the very thing that paid for my bills and gave me the illusion of surviving. Ironically, being a very dangerous sport, as my therapist says, is like walking the tightrope of death every day. Because I mean, it just took one fall the right way, and you know, we've had that have been paralyzed or have died from action sports. Today, I realized that it's not been easy. It's taken a lot of work, a lot of years, and a lot of self drive to understand these different components of being human and the psychology and the biology of change. And to go back to the direct answer to your question is my definition of winning. It's not even winning, really isn't even in my vocabulary anymore, because to me, it's just an illusion. Because to say you win implies that you lost, or I mean, to say you win or lose, I mean, it implies one or the other has to be true. I don't see it that way. So yeah, I guess categorically, if we're looking at an event to win or lose, that's one perspective. I just don't see things as black and white, or try not to see things as black and white like that today because of the implications to the subconscious. And when it was about winning to survive, I didn't know it. That was a lot of force and energy that accumulated a lot of costs in the form of stress. And in my case, I believe brain tumors. So the way I look at it today is like, let's just see where I can go, how far I can grow and expand my vision. And let's see what I can learn along the way, rather than, am I winning? Am I getting there or am I not? So I don't know if that makes sense. I just...
No, 100% it does. I think would love to unpack a little bit more about, you know, attributing yourself to a certain job, or like a lot of athletes, I feel like they struggle with, you know, they play sport for their whole lives. And then who are they without that sport? And I think there is so much that needs to be done, especially the work with young athletes. And only a few percent of college athletes are going to make it pro, right? And what do you do if you have focused your entire career on, you know, being a football player or a basketball player, et cetera? And I think looking at the research of Carl Jung, the Swiss psychologist, how do you separate yourself from like the ego and separate yourself from what you do and actually grow as a person outside of your craft? And I'm so curious to hear how your process of, you know, separating yourself from being an athlete and being pushing through all the injuries and despite health complications, because it was probably 2 years to actually realize, well, I can't do this anymore and I have to do something else.
Yeah, I don't look at it as separating myself from my ego as much as I look at it mm-hmm. as separating myself from labels and outcomes.
Okay.
Because my understanding is to fight off the ego or to kill off the ego or to, you know, resist the ego creates more resistance. And it's like this battle against self when self isn't the problem. That's my take. So it's working with. That's something I've picked up from people like Carl Jung and also people I learned about the nervous system from. It's like, the more we try to fight against something, what does that imply? Like, it implies there's a barrier, there's going to be resistance, and that's the forceful energy. And when we can work with, there's more of an allowance, and that allowance, it creates availability, creates space. So rather than what I didn't know what I was doing before was trying to fight against myself, the idea that I wasn't good enough, mm-hmm. only reinforced and expanded the not good enough belief that I wasn't even aware I had, because it wasn't even a belief. It was just who I was to myself was not good enough. And so today I do my best to be consciously aware of, when am I collapsing worth, value, security, safety with external factors, whether it be a label, it'd be a result, it'd be an outcome, it'd be a performance of some sort, because that's the dance, is it's catching when you're doing that. That's what the ego wants to do, is to think it needs to be or needs to do in order to feel the safety, or, you know, if we get vulnerable enough, that's what it goes down to deep at the core, or wired to survive. So today I do my best to continue learning and continue having grace with myself rather than shaming myself, which no one, even David Goggins in the day, could tell me something I didn't already know or think. No one else outside of me could make me feel worse than I already made myself feel, which drove me to do things extraordinary. It does that for a lot of high-performing athletes and executives and artists, and you know, the list goes on. And it's a lot of force, creates a lot of dysfunction and dis-ease in the body and relationships and life. And I just believe there's a different way to go about it. There's nothing wrong with hard work. There's nothing wrong with discipline. I didn't realize I was black and white with discipline, because I didn't have any discipline with my, how would I word this? I was disciplined with doing the work. I wasn't as disciplined with recovery.
Yeah.
I didn't have the constraint, which I believe is the other side of the coin of discipline, is restraint. And I'd be really restraining of a lot of things, and I wouldn't have any allowance of things. So it was like, it was back and forth, black and white. So that's kind of how I look at things today, is like, where am I collapsing my sense of self with doing something or achieving something or attaining something? Because that becomes the trap, and that's where we become, performance can become the invisible trap.
Yeah, I mean, super fascinating. I feel like a lot of people struggle with that, right? Could be athletes, as you said, executives, you know, people in very demanding positions. I think it's so difficult to maintain expectations. And the better you become, the harder it becomes to actually separate yourself from like who you are at work, and actually talking about restraint, finding that balance between performance and actually taking a step back, reflecting, evaluating whatever it is you have to go through. Curious to hear your opinion on internal conflict. I feel like a lot of people go through that in different stages of their lives, between who am I? What does it mean to be, you know, X, Y, or Z? And I feel like a lot of internal conflicts then translate into organizational conflict. Mm-hmm. And if you can give some advice about how can somebody, you know, an athlete or outside, become better at being at peace with themselves so that then they can be better for their teams.
I think the first step to be having more peace with self is to accept. It's not about wanting or liking. It's just about accepting what is, because you can work with that. But you mentioned expectation. I think that's what gets a lot of, I'd say every human being goes through this at least once in their life. If they can acknowledge that, then they're human, right? But like, we have these unspoken, unconscious expectations about how the way the world should work, how a relationship should work, how our boss should work, how our finances should work, how our health should work, how we should work. And I think that's a trap, because that's an illusion, right? And that's when those things don't go the way we think they should, then we have conflict, whether it's a person, it's ourself, it's a circumstance. And that's all like the three-dimensional world of change, of, you know, here are my circumstances, here's my behavior, here's my results. A lot of us tend to start with results, the ones we have that we don't want, or the ones that we don't have that we do want. And then we go back up to behavior. I'm gonna change my behavior. And then we go, we say, oh, it's because of my circumstances. So either that becomes a victim mentality. It's like, I feel limited or stuck or frustrated because of this person, place, thing, or experience in my environment, the circumstance. Or we use the circumstance to validate ourselves. And then we get into that cycle of just, I'm going to try to manipulate my circumstances. If I'm not being a victim to them, I'm going to try to change them. And meanwhile, that's just downstream. If we go upstream, what I work with is the five-dimensional aspect of change. It starts with identity. Because identity, which a lot of us aren't even aware, we just label ourselves. My name's Josh. I'm a former pro BMX athlete. I'm a high-performance coach today. I live in North Carolina. That's all labels. And all those things can change. So is that who we truly are? Or is that just a convincing conversation we've had in our mind over and over again that leads us to believe that's who we are? Because my assertion that anything that can change is not who you are. And so usually when people interview me on podcasts these days, they're like, yeah, so Josh, tell us who you are. And if I want to mess with them, I'm like, I'm consciously curious of what's capable or what I'm capable of in the world. And they're like, what do you mean? I'm like, well, oh, you want me to say my name? Like, you know, but if we go upstream to the source, you know, I guess this is a better analogy. The identity is what breeds the perspective or the perception we have of the world. And then that's what filters the circumstance, which leads to the other 3D model. But if we work with identity and then we go to perception, then we can understand how we're interpreting the environment, how we're interpreting circumstances. And then all that influences our state of being, our emotions, our feelings, all the energy inside of our bodies. That's the most impactful influence of behavior. It's not logic, because if that was so simple, we would all be doing the things we should be doing. And then if you understand that you work from that top-down model upstream, then results just start to handle themselves. You don't have to focus on results. So the same thing if, you know, I use this analogy, if you're in the NBA, and are you going to stand there on the court and just watch the scoreboard and hope it changes? Or are you going to play the game?
Yeah.
And to play the game at that level, there's got to be a level of identity that knows it's possible to play at that level.
Yeah.
So that's... yeah, that's how I look at these things. It's there's an invisible world that keeps us from the things we want.
Yeah.
And if we have unmet, unspoken, unconscious expectations, well, that's where we start. It's like, let's start with your language. How are you describing your life right now in your world? Because that gives us insight into the unconscious. As you very well know, Carl Jung is one of my favorite quotes of him. Until you make the unconscious conscious, it'll drive your life and you'll call it fate. So how do we bring out the unconscious and look at it and work with it rather than fight ourselves? And we're always going to be right at the core that we're not good enough. We'll find ways to create those experiences to validate why we feel the way we do.
So fascinating. Do you feel like people that are, you know, trying to, you know, like they say, hey, I'm going to move to a different country, I'm going to quit my job, something new, do something else. Do you feel like they're seeking an identity change because they just can't figure out who they are and they're trying to find that different like escape mechanism rather than, you know, focus on what they have and try to build it into what it is they want to have at the end of the day?
Maybe. I see it more as they're trying to find themselves. They're trying to find connection. And that's, I mean, you can look at how many artists in the world that have literally have lyrics saying that the loneliest is when they're on stage in front of thousands of people. And that's going again to circumstances. If we don't feel connected to ourselves for whatever the reason is, we try to change our circumstances and we're going to be around a lot of people and we feel even lonelier because we're disconnected is what we feel. But we're not actually disconnected with the people, we're disconnected with ourselves. That creates the illusion that to have someone in my life is going to help me feel better.
Yeah.
There's nothing wrong with that. It doesn't work. Yeah. And it may work for some time until it doesn't, because something else in the circumstance may change. And then the root or issue isn't been handled, which is, yeah, the sense of self. It's this, I need to be with people in this case, or I need to go change my, you know, my doings in the world to be around people. Meanwhile, it's all of this. It's all pointing outward rather than like inward. Like, why am I feeling this way? What am I avoiding? What does it mean to me to be in this situation? As broadly as that is, it's really the meaning that gives us access into the core of who we think we are.
Yeah. I mean, and I think this certainly applies to some of the top performing athletes too. And just because we see them on TV, you know, playing football or whatever it might be, we have no idea what they could be struggling with internally. Curious to hear your opinion about what can organizations do, and team leaders and coaches and, you know, some of the organizational staff to like do to prevent and encourage, you know, essentially encourage athletes to speak up and to do some, you know, organizational work with them and really to enhance those team dynamics and team trust and team cohesion. Because I believe that if you have individual issues and you have locker room dynamic problems, and it's all rooted in the individuals, and that deeply affects performance. So I think what we've been discussing now is so accurate, and not many people are aware of it, because at the end of the day, we're all people, right? We're trying to compete at the top level outside, or, you know, in sports or outside of that. So genuinely curious to hear your opinion how organizations can be better to support their staff and their players.
I'd be curious of what you think about this, because my perspective is it starts at the top. It starts with leadership. And leadership is not a badge of honor. It's not a title. It's not something that you do. It's either an example or it's a warning. And so if we consider that every human being, every ego wants to be seen, heard, and safe, they want to feel safe, they want to be acknowledged, and they want to be validated. It doesn't matter about if it's true or not. It's, you know, it's, we want to just feel seen and heard. Like, yeah, that must be tough for you. And that may not be my perspective, but it sounds like, you know, we're not saying that, but like, you know, in our head, but like that must be tough for you. I get that. Yeah. If people at the top aren't doing that, then how can they expect anyone in the, you know, below in the organizational chart, or if a coach in the team, right? How can they expect people to feel safe and being vulnerable if they're already feeling shame? And this, you know, this isn't about fault and blame. I don't believe that actually does anything. I just believe it makes things worse or expands them. But yeah, it starts at the top. If the leadership isn't demonstrating these human qualities, these communication pieces, and helping people feel seen and heard and feeling of safety, then they can't expect anything else from what they're doing as their best. Because, I mean, it's if you have an athlete that's not opening up, it's for a reason. If all of a sudden someone's patterns change and they're like not performing well, or showing up late, or they look tired, or like they look distracted, to tell them to like get it together and do more is probably going to make them feel even worse. And so they may be able to snap out of it and like force it, but that's half therapy at best. It's going to come out. The rails are going to go off, or the wheels are going to go off the rails at some point, and there's going to be a bigger issue to handle.
Yeah.
Rather than it's like, you know, hey, Anna, I noticed you're a little late the last couple of days, or you look distracted. Like, is everything okay? You want to talk about anything? Like, it's just such a different approach. But if the people at the top are so uncomfortable that they don't even realize it, that their perception of their team is making them feel uncomfortable, then that, again, it starts at the top. How is a leader that isn't aware that other people not performing well, or, you know, sales goals not being met, or the win rate isn't going the way they want, how that impacts them, and then they show up trying to force the inverse of it, if you're aware of that, then it's just going to continue to magnify things. And then coaches get fired, CEOs replaced, or team members come and go. Like, it all starts up. If you're not demonstrating it, then you're creating a warning that, oh, I can't be vulnerable. I can't be myself.
100%. I couldn't agree more. At SCI, we do a lot of conflict training for, different organizations. And I think what's the most important is, don't jump to assumptions about another person. Like, when you're going through something, just actually have that skill of active listening, which is so much harder than people think it is, right? Like, essentially, when there is a conflict, so many people already come up with a response in their head while somebody else is speaking. So not many people actually know what it is to hear someone and reflect and actually take a step back. And it's such a crucial step, as well as like understanding what is this really about and why is this other person, being upset, or what's happening in their home, and what could be the reason behind their performance or their, behavior, etc. And I think another, like a personal favorite of mine, is helping people figure out solutions together. So there's a lot of people in power, right, outside of sports or in sports, they tend to just deliver the outcome and come up with a solution. And not many people realize the importance of just sitting across the other person being like, hey, let's figure this out together. Like, what is going to make this a fair process to you? How can I ensure that what you want to get out of this is heard? Because leadership is not about saying how it's going to go, right? Yeah. Leadership is about creating that trust within the organization where people feel that they can come to you and share things, right? They know that the process will be fair, that this person is going to have, my back when something doesn't go right. So I totally agree. And I think it's really spans an important discussion about, how it is to be a good parent or a good, whatever it might be, because leadership comes in so many different forms. It doesn't just have to be work related.
Yeah, it goes back to what you said earlier about people already having responses in their head. And if a leader is already trying to come up with things, or already is, overstepping the conversation, interrupting, it reminds me of a concept of like being in a relationship, like an intimate relationship with another person. Like right now, you and I are in a relationship in this conversation. I'm not relating to you in a way that is what's best for me. So that's what I used to do, and it showed up in my marriage. Whenever my wife would have an issue or be in some type of distress, my discomfort would take over. I wouldn't be in an intimate relationship with her. I'd be relating to her through the lens of my identity that couldn't handle someone I loved being uncomfortable or at distress. And I see that with a lot of leaders, is it's all these unconscious decisions that are being made about what that moment or what that person's doing means about them or could mean. And so they're not in a relationship in the moment, even in life. They're relating to them through their own sense of survival. And that's why people interrupt so much and try to control the situation or conversation, or at the very extreme, like, be manipulative. It's because their own insecurity of the thing, their own inadequacy that's being sensed without them even realizing it. And that's a hard conversation to have. And thankfully, I have a lot of leaders I work with that want to get into that vulnerable place because they know what's on the other side. That's freedom. That's everything they want for their team or for their family or their lives. But you're not in a relationship if all you know is relating to people in the world through a lens of survival.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious to hear a little bit more about the MITO philosophy that you practice in, your career right now, and, how it can be used in burnout and, one's evolution when it comes to, building that identity that, it's going to be best for one's life.
So MITO has been like a 7-year vision for me that is an acronym for Mastering Intentions Through Ownership, which has evolved since the first evolution of it, evolution of it in 2019. And it's a short for mitochondria. Mitochondria, as people may be aware of, is just like, it's the energy producing aspect of being human. If we don't have mitochondria, my understanding is we don't produce energy and we die. So if we understand that mitochondria is really important, because like, I used to be very much a nerd in metabolic health, and that's where I started coaching, is health coaching, and really into metabolic health and learning about all these things. And then over the years, as I've evolved my thinking and my process, to be like, oh, there's a huge mental and emotional component of what I do. I don't even see it. And then I became a nerd of that path. And so for me, it's just something I'm working on creating. It's a brand beyond my name. Like, I want it to be something that lands for people in a way that they can resonate with it, and they can share it, and they can move into organizations and homes and teams, and, you know, just be something bigger than me. And I want it to be about the purpose, which is helping people. Currently, my latest evolution of what my purpose is to help people transcend performance, transcend the identity that needs to perform, that needs things to go the way they want it to go, to feel okay. And my work's a lot about uncovering those mental prisons and asking yourself, can I be okay when things aren't going okay? I believe that's true. I believe that's possible. And so mito is just, it's just been my passion that up until a year ago, I kept in the dark and didn't share because I didn't think it was good enough. And I thought it had to be this, had to be that. And the way I work is I don't have a structured program. When people ask me, you know, what's your methodology? What's the program? I'm like, you. Where you show up, I meet you, and we go where you tell me you want to go. And what I pick up on is what's underneath the surface. So, of course, I have a lot of frameworks and models, but mito for me is just like the highest, you know, in the clouds idea of what I'm trying to bring to the world.
That's super interesting. I feel like that, you know, personal, like developing a program that's personal and individual to organizations and people is so crucial, because, you know, conflict and internal conflict and all the struggles, I feel everybody suffers through them. And it's about, you know, finding that right key to the right lock. So last question, if I may, we talked a lot about, you know, how people show up for themselves. And what I've noticed in my practice is that how people behave in their day-to-day is very different for how they behave under pressure and in high performance environments. Mm-hmm. Could you speak a little bit on your experience and how you navigated that and what you see, you know, in the space?
Yeah, I mean, starting with myself, I first had to realize what my default mode was under stress. It's easy to practice theory and, you know, sunshine and rainbows. A whole different story when you're in a high pressure situation or a stressful situation. Either way, they act on the same mechanism in our body, and it's very different. And so who are you when things aren't going the way you want them to go? Who are you when things aren't okay?
Yeah.
It starts with that self audit, that self assessment. And that's what I did for myself. At the time, I wanted to perform at a higher level in BMX. And then I started to see it transcend to other aspects of my life, my relationships, my health, you know, my vision, my mentality, my business. And so, yeah, I mean, I think it just comes down to that aspect of self-assessment and self-awareness and self-auditing and asking yourself those questions when no one's around. Like, what are your thoughts? Like, how much time do people think that they spend avoiding their thoughts, their emotions? Like, we have anything from distraction, from food to entertainment to porn to gambling to alcohol, yeah, to drugs to shopping, like to sex, to all these things. There's nothing wrong with any of them. And if we can, you know, I got this from Dr. Gabor Mate, if we can look at what that thing is doing for the person, for the human, for the organism, what they're getting out of it that they're missing in the rest of their lives, then we can work with it rather than shame and saying the obvious, like it's not healthy.
Yeah.
If we don't have those conversations with ourselves, again, it's going to be three-dimensional. It's going to be, I'm going to try to change my circumstances or change my behavior to get different results. And my quest, my journey has shown me it's deeper than that. It's just uncomfortable. And that's the human design, to keep us feeling comfortable. But discomfort is what gets us to move. And if we don't have that, then how can we expect to grow? And a lot of people are maybe satisfied with being, you know, where they are. Maybe that's in the moment. Maybe that's their way of staying safe, which ironically becomes a paradox of creating more suffering down the line. So I think the first thing is really, there's no judgment here. I know where I've come from. I know how difficult it's been. I know looking back and I'm like, oh, I can see it's so obvious. Just running around in circles, doing the same shit, complaining about it and actually expecting a different result. I get it. Yeah. We're all human. It's just my commitment to continue to do this work, to continue to remember, and then shorten the window of how long it takes me to realize I forgot so I can remember again.
Yeah. I mean, I think it takes a lot of mental strength to actually realize flaws within yourself and take that leap as to like, hey, how can I be better for my employees? How can I be better for my organization? How can I be better for myself at the end of the day? And well, thank you so much, Josh, for sharing your wisdom today. It's been so great talking to you again. And your story is just fascinating. And I feel like it's a perfect example of, you know, dedication, resilience, and just such a great and positive outlook on life. And I feel like our listeners will greatly appreciate everything that you shared today. So thank you so much. We look forward to, you know, supporting you on your journey, and, you know, we're going to be in touch.
Well, I appreciate you having me on, Anna. It's been a pleasure. This is, I mean, our second conversation that we've had since meeting, and it's been very, very fun and enjoyable. And I appreciate the time, the energy, and I hope people take away something of a perspective shift. That's what it's all about. And I look forward to more of our conversations.
Thank you so much, Josh. Have a wonderful day.
Thank you. You too.